KFMB.
San Diego's talk radio leader, 760 KFMB presents It's Your Money, Not Theirs. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future. Now, It's Your Money, Not Theirs on Talk Radio 760 KFMB.
It's Your Money, Not Theirs. I'm Joe Vecchio. Good evening and welcome to It's Your Money, Not Theirs. I'm Joe Vecchio, your co-host, announcer, and producer for the show. We got a really special live presentation this evening, and we're broadcasting with 50,000 watts of power all over Southern California, up to Orange County, LA County, up to Seattle on a good night, out to the desert. And now it's time to introduce the main man of the hour, CPA, family office advisor, marathon runner, star core member of Strategic Trusted Advisors Roundtable of San Diego, the magnificent Richard Muzio. Good evening, Richard. How are you?
Oh, thanks, Joe. I thought you were describing somebody else.
Hey, what a day this is. I think I lost a half a pound from sweating today.
Joe, you were so nervous that, well, I'm not going to say it, but...
And we've got a great guest, so I don't want to take too much time, yeah. But...
Tell us why you were so nervous.
Well, this is kind of historic. I don't think KFMB AM has ever broadcast live from the historic La Valencia Hotel before. Have they, Dave? No, this is a first. So this is July 8th, 2012. I just want everyone to know, and we are live at the Welling Bar of the La Valencia Hotel, which is a national and probably in a lot of respects an international landmark. I know it, well, it is a U.S. national landmark. And today was the culmination of probably, I would say, at least 10 years of thought of this project. As most people may know, if you've ever been here, I mean, Hollywood figures came to this place starting, I think, in the 30s. And, you know, there are pictures around the wall. You see, you know, Lon Chaney and Lillian Gish and Greta Garbo, but many, many, many other notables have been through here. Walter Cronkite loved this place. John Chancellor, Victor Mature, Charlton Heston. You can go on and on and on. Barbara Streisand, I've been told, comes through here. And most people do not know that Dr. Seuss, Ted Geisel, in San Diego, I don't think they know. He wrote, well, he moved this to La Jolla in 1948, up above the La Jolla Country Club, and wrote... 6 books before he got there, but all the rest of his 60 books were written and illustrated by him in that house, in his studio, from 1948 to 1991. And so I wanted to somehow dedicate that fact in San Diego, in La Jolla somewhere. And right around 03, I got in touch with Mrs. Geisel, and she liked the idea, but she said, why don't you wait a year after the Seuss Centennial, which was 2004. And so then 2005, I started again in earnest trying to find where we could put this plaque and what it should say, et cetera, et cetera. And to make a long story short, today we found out that booth number 3 in the Welling Bar here was his favorite table for all those years. And we actually unveiled the plaque today with... 40 to 60 of Audrey's closest friends and relatives and everybody else here. So it was quite a day. And the general manager of the hotel and you, Richard, are two key people. I guess we three together kind of helped help this occur. So I want to thank you and for your role in all this. And
My pleasure. And I want to thank the owner of La Valencia, Mr. Ashish Rani, as well as the executive director, Mr. Vikram Sood, for all of their help in helping us pull this on.
Right. They underwrote everything. And then we'll get to our esteemed guest in one moment. I just want to read the plaque because it's very short. But if you come to the La Valencia, look for it. It'll be in booth 3. It just says, in honor of Ted Geisel, Dr. Seuss, in parentheses, in commemoration and in deep gratitude for all of his many wonderful books written and illustrated at his La Jolla residence from 1948 to 1991 and enjoyed the world over by millions of children and adults alike. You are seated at the table that was his favorite. So come out here and get inspired and have a nice meal and a glass of wine. So anyway, we've got a great guest tonight, Richard, to top it all off, another icon, you might say, in the sports broadcasting world. And who should introduce him? I guess
you can introduce him.
Well, I mean, this gentleman's done every major sporting event on the planet, and now he's just enjoying living in San Diego and La Jolla and broadcasting the Padres game. And I'd like to welcome to our show the great, the one, the only Dick Enberg. Dick, good evening.
Joe, thank you. I'm wondering what Mr. Geisel had. What was his favorite meal and favorite wine?
You know, we'll have to find that out. I didn't know.
It was probably green eggs and ham, Dick.
Not our favorite, obviously.
I do think he liked a vodka martini now and again, but I'll find that out for you. And I'm sweating again, for God's sake.
Yeah, it looks like you're the marathon runner.
How does Roger Federer? Now, you watched the Wimbledon today, I think.
Got a taste of it on my way to the ballpark. We had a 1 o'clock game, and it was predictable. In fact, I even told my friends, I think Murray will win the first set, but if he doesn't win the second, then it's all over.
Yeah.
And the pressure on Murray is just enormous. Mm-hmm. There's nothing like that in the United States. When you think about Great Britain, we're talking about a small country, and Wimbledon is their midsummer Super Bowl classic. Mm-hmm. I mean, the country almost comes to a halt for 2 weeks. And mm-hmm. When I first went over there, BBC One and BBC Two carried action all day long throughout the entire tournament. Yeah. It has been reduced now as television has changed.
And that's their favorite son, yeah. Obviously. And he was, did you see the end? I mean, I was getting teary. McEnroe, who, you know, is not an emotional guy. I mean,
he is.
Well, I mean, he's emotional in a lot of, I mean, as far as getting teary-eyed, you know, I know he's emotional.
he's softer than you think.
Really?
I've worked next to him, and he has really mellowed through the years.
Well, that's a good thing to note. But Murray was almost, he couldn't get through it. He was breaking down in tears at the end.
Well, you know, that's think about the pressure on this, and the entire country's pushing him. They haven't had someone in the finals since 1938, Bunny Austin. They haven't had a champion of their own tennis event. Think of our event. We said, well, we haven't had an American champion at the U.S. Open. Andy Roddick's been, what is it, almost 10 years? It's been 75 years since they had someone even in the finals. So the whole country just pushing this guy, Marin. Each year he gets a little bit better, a little bit better, and maybe he'll win. I hope they do. The country deserves it. They have patiently cheered everyone from every country around the world, and that they're sold out every event, every court, and they deserve, if any place deserves to have their own champion, it's Great Britain.
Well, it was Fred Perry, 1936.
Right.
But, you know, I watched the match, Dick. Andy Murray actually played quite well. Just Roger Federer took the match from him. Roger just said, you know what, this is number 17 for me, Wimbledon number 7. It wasn't that, you know, Andy's three previous, I think, finals and Grand Slams, he simply didn't play well, but that wasn't the case today.
No, Federer beat him, and he's a marvelous champion to represent the sport.
And how come this guy does not perspire? I mean,
I wondered that.
Is that, I mean, he's a freak of nature. I mean, how do you play in that heat and not perspire? It's unbelievable.
No, he's...
I don't know, Joe. He's just a great player. So, Dick, any regrets? I know you did Wimbledon for 28 years. You weren't there to watch history, so to speak, because Serena won yesterday, too, on the women's side.
Right.
Her 14th slam and 5th Wimbledon.
Well, I do have a few regrets, but I ruminated over the decision, whether I wanted to give up NFL football and college basketball and the 4 Grand Slams before I said yes to the Padres and the opportunity to do their games. And it's a relentless schedule. And after trying to do both Wimbledon and U.S. Open and baseball and being away 15 days from the baseball season, it just became apparent that I had to decide what is it that I'm really going to do the rest of my life, and baseball is it. And I have no regrets about that. And I'm complimented that people will actually come up to me, and it's happened throughout the fortnight, saying, "Well, we miss you at Wimbledon." Well, thank you. I wish you'd have told me that before.
Hey, are you going to go to the La Costa tournament when it comes through here?
Well, again, baseball, kind of ties you up. It's taken a lot away from me. I can't go to Del Mar. I'd like to go to the racetrack a couple of times a week, too, when the season begins.
Yeah, so, but let's run down some of Dick's accomplishments. I mean, 14 NCAA basketball Final Fours, 10 Super Bowls, 28 Wimbledons, 3 Olympics, 9 Rose Bowls, 9 National Sportscaster of the Year Awards, 13 Emmys, and you're in the Pro Football and Basketball Hall of Fame. I mean, and that's just some of it. So,
I've been privileged.
Yes. Now, you grew up in Michigan. We had a little breakfast meeting a couple months ago, and where did it all begin for you? I mean, you were
I grew up on a farm. I went to a one-room school and through the 8th grade, high school class of 33.
In Michigan.
In Michigan, north of Detroit. We had a farm. It was a fruit farm, mostly apples, and no indoor plumbing, and you learned some humility under those conditions. My dad always said no. He was a full-blooded Finn, a real tough guy. Never complimented me, pushed me because he was a depression guy himself, and he was afraid his kids would be soft. Hitchhiked almost everywhere I went. If I go to a ball game in Detroit, I'd hitchhike in. Had to borrow a coat from a sports coat from a friend in my senior high school because I didn't have one for the senior picture. And then somehow found myself going to college. I was a good student. My mother made sure of that. And received a $100 scholarship to go to Central Michigan, a teacher's college. I said, "You mean they pay you to go to school? I got to take this. That's a lot of money."
That's the Chippewas, right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. The Fighting Chippewas.
But I hear some music, so we've got to take a short break. We'll be right back with more of It's Your Money Not There. Stay tuned. Or was that a break? I thought I heard music. No, it wasn't a break.
Keep going, Joe.
Welcome back. Boy, thanks for sticking through the break with us, folks. You're terrific. I appreciate the
loyalty.
Is
this a comedy show? I got some good jokes for you.
We could run one by us at the break, and we'll see. But anyway, what were we talking about? The Hall of Fame. Where? I lost my train of thought.
You went to Central Michigan.
Oh, yeah.
But your first broadcasting job was because you went to Indiana University then for...
No. My first broadcasting job, I was... I had to drop out of school after my first 2 years. I ran out of money. And my dad, actually, and I both took a job in Hamtramck, Michigan at the Dodge Main Assembly Plant. And I put on front bumpers on 55 Dodges. Mm-hmm. If you ever see one of those classics and one of the bumpers is kind of hanging off to the right, that was the one I put on. First time I ever heard a woman swear. My mother was very religious. And on the assembly line, you know, the line keeps going. And if you have a fumbling young kid trying to put bolts and nuts together in a bumper on a thing, and I'd never heard that language before. And then this young kid started dropping more bolts and nuts. And I realized in a hurry how fortunate I was to be able to go to college. And I made a lot of it. It was like $220 an hour you made on the assembly line. And I got back to school and went on to get a part-time job. And my fraternity brother said, you know, I'm leaving. I'm getting $1 an hour as a custodian at the only radio station in Mount Pleasant, Michigan. I said, could you put in a good word for me? You're graduating. He did. I went out to the radio station. Never been in a radio station. Go in. Said, I'd like to apply for the custodial job. And I had worked one summer as a custodian in another plant. And he said, yeah, Enver, you got a decent voice. He said, why don't you sit in that booth over there? And they gave me a 5-minute news summary and a couple of commercials. And he said, read. I said, well, do I get a chance to read it over first? He said, no, let's just see what you do if you read it, how you read it cold.
How old were you at the time?
I'm 21.
Wow, okay.
And so I read it. I mean, hey, Central Michigan Junior, I can read, you know. Mm-hmm. And and so I left, and 3 weeks later I get a call, and it's the... It must have been a very significant event in my life because I can remember Russ Holcomb was his name, the general manager of this little radio station. Kind of a pedantic sort. He claimed he went to University of Chicago. None of us believe it. Anyway, what was he doing in Mount Pleasant, Michigan? Anyway, he called and called me in. He said, you have the job. And I said, well, where's the broom closet? You know, I'm ready to go. He said, no, we think you could be our new weekend disc jockey. And I said, oh, yeah, and you mean I've got that job? And he said, yeah. I said, how much does that pay? Yeah. He said, $1 an hour. Oh, same as the custodian. So that's how it all started.
Oh, my God. But you've been cleaning up pretty good.
Sure, that's sort of how this show started, by the way.
Well, that's outstanding. So after that station, then what happened?
Well, then but the sportscasting job opened up 3 weeks later because the sportscaster left. They knew of my passion for sports, and they said, would you like to try that? And then here I am in college doing the college and high school football games, basketball games, in a market where as long as you got the final score right and you pronounce the surnames correctly, mm-hmm. they were patient with you. And after a couple of years, you know, actually I thought I was pretty good.
Okay, so is the break coming up, Dave? Okay, well, look, let's take our break now, Dave. Is everybody on board with that? So we'll be right back with more of It's Your Money Not There. Stay tuned.
Oh, my.
Follow Sean.
We are back with more of It's Your Money Not There with our esteemed guests, Dick Enberg, and myself and Richard Musio. So back to you, Richard. What are we getting to now?
We're going to stay on tennis because what happened over at Wimbledon this weekend, it's only the third time in Grand Slam history that the two winners, the men's and the women's winners, were at least 30 years of age. Of course, this year, Serena Williams yesterday, Roger Federer today. Back in 75, Arthur Ashe and Billie Jean King were Wimbledon winners. And then back in 68, it was the same story, two 30-year-olds, Rod Laver and Ann Joan. But the interesting thing about Billie Jean King, 1975, is that, well, it was also the 40th anniversary this year of Title IX, and next year is the 40th anniversary of the Battle of the Sexes.
Right.
And so a lot of history going on that all seems to be tied together. Dick, the greatest tennis players you've ever seen? I mean, I know you've seen Serena. I know you've seen Roger. Serena, I think, has 14 Grand Slams. Margaret Court won 24 on the women's side. Who's the greatest women player?
Tough. You know, that's very difficult. I hoped you were going to ask me about the men's side.
I didn't see
Rod Laver play, and so he, you know, arguably he's the best ever. But if he isn't, then you know, the man that won the title today, Roger Federer, is, and he's been a tremendous model for all of us who love tennis. He's just a gentleman, a brilliant guy. The way he plays the game so effortlessly, and he talked earlier about he doesn't perspire. Mm-hmm. But Federer certainly is in the discussion because of his complete game. I mean, Nadal might wind up winning more majors than Federer, but he's going to win them on that red clay stuff and not on all surfaces. But going back to women, rather than picking one, I wish I'd have seen. Here we are in La Jolla, and within walking distance are the courts where Mo Connolly played. Mm-hmm. And she won, three Wimbledon titles? And I don't think she was 21 when she won the third.
I think she was 21 at the third one.
Third one.
Yeah.
And so how good would she have been before the accident and that took her career away? You got to put Martina Navratilova at her time in the conversation. We all thought, will anyone ever beat this woman who seems so much stronger than all the rest? I mean, just on the fact that I was in love with her, Chris Evert, I think a lot of men were. You know, I got to give her a vote. She may not be the greatest ever, but it's on clay. She who else? And Steffi Graf, my goodness, she wins the Golden Slam. She wins all four majors and the Olympic Games all in the same year.
Yeah.
It's a really tough call.
Now, did you see Margaret Court play at all?
I did not.
She's got the most Grand Slams.
Yeah, but she
all.
Dominated. A lot of that was doubles and mixed doubles.
True.
But at her time was a powerful. She was the Martina of her time. But can I throw Venus into the conversation, too?
Yeah.
Well, I think you have to.
The two together are by far the greatest sibling combination in the history of all sports. Not tennis, of all sports. Those two.
I agree. And if anybody missed it, they won the women's doubles.
Just to prove the point.
Just to prove the point yet again.
I don't think we'll ever see siblings, even whether they're both women or both men or male and female, winning a Grand Slam in tennis from the same family. I mean, that is so unbelievable because typically there's sibling rivalry, and these two are tremendous friends, but...
And that's why their matches were really, when they got to the finals and played each other, were really not very interesting. Yeah. One, for whom do you cheer?
Yeah.
And neither one wanted to win, but they didn't want to beat their sister.
Yeah,
so what
I
kind
know.
Of drama is that?
I know.
And then when you think about it, Richard Williams is a fox, but how he raised those two young ladies and made them champions in such an unorthodox way. I mean, he held them back, reined them back. He wouldn't let them go out and play junior tournaments. Today, if you have a kid that's really going to be a top here in San Diego, a top player in the state, you're going to put them in the tournaments and try them out in the state and the nationals. And I think some of the young kids, by the time they're 15, 16,
burned out.
Exactly. Yeah. And he didn't let that happen.
And even at an early age, they were carrying phone books, I think at the age of 4 or 5, delivering phone books with him. And that's probably helped build their strength at an early age, which most parents wouldn't even think of.
Richard, whom would you vote for as the best woman player?
Well, the best woman I saw play was Steffi Graf, although I saw Martina sort of past her prime. They say Margaret Court was the most dominant women's player. She did win 24 singles Grand Slam championships and 60-something Grand Slams. But you have to question the level of competition back in the late 50s through the late 60s.
And we're talking now about Title IX and what has been produced. Yeah,
exactly. Mm-hmm. And what's come after Title IX. By the way, Margaret Court beat Billie Jean 22-10 lifetime. That's a point of interest that I think is very relevant for this project we have going on.
And I'm sorry I didn't put Billie Jean King in the conversation.
Oh, great champion. Billie Jean's a great champion. And you talk about the pressure that Murray faced. I mean, the pressure that Billie Jean faced in the Battle of the Sexes was incredible back in September of 73.
Mm-hmm. Did you think that... Billie Jean or Riggs was going to win that? Were you even alive then?
Yeah. But let's hold that thought right there, gentlemen, because we have to take a break. We'll be right back with more
Adventure
Money.
I wanted the answer.
You'll get it.
Stay around after the break, and we'll get it. We'll be right back after these announcements. All right, we're back with more of Mr. Money Not Theirs, coming to you live from the La Valencia Hotel in beautiful La Jolla, in the bar, the historic Whaling Bar, back with Dick Enberg and Richard Musio and myself. So where did we leave off an answer to?
I'm going to answer Dick's question, but we have to thank all of our sponsors, including La Valencia Hotel, for this great day we've had today. And, of course, let's just name them. I mean, it's a lot of sponsors, and everybody contributed in great ways. Pluto Epic, CPAs up in Vista, Rich Gaines and Family Legacy Legal, UBS, our major sponsor, Mike Coranta and Michael Kaniger were here. So thanks for your support, guys. Jason Kruger with Signature Analytics, Carl Sheeler with Business Valuations Limited. And if I forgot anybody, it would be Regions Bank. And they're right across the street here from La Valencia. We had Sean Puckett and Steve Sefton, and they're lovely. Is out to join the festivities as well. So everybody, thank you. So Dick, to answer your question, did we think Bobby was going to win? We thought Bobby was going to win because he dominated Margaret Court 6-2, 6-1. Margaret at the time was number one in the world. Billie Jean was number two. And Margaret had beaten Billie Jean at the time 21 out of 30 times, ultimately 22 out of 32 in their careers. But there was a big difference. Bobby trained very hard against Margaret Court, and he trained not at all, unless you count drinking martinis as elbow exercise for your serve.
Ain't nobody's perfect.
And so after about three, and then further, it was, you remember the Houston Astrodome, of course, it was never really hot Astrodome because of the air conditioning, but it was very, very humid. And Bobby, of course, came out in the warm-ups and for the first three games of the Billie Jean King match, wore a Nabisco jacket that said Sugar Daddy on it. He was promoting Sugar Daddies, the candy bar that Nabisco sold. He was sweating profusely. How you said that Federer doesn't sweat? Well, Bobby was sweating in the warm-ups, and he kept the jacket on for three games, and I was there with my uncle, John Riggs, Bobby's older brother, and he said after three games, this is not looking good. And boy, was he ever right.
Hey, and tell Dick all the professional black athletes who were there, and I think only one was, I think Jim Brown was the only one rooting for Bobby, but all the others.
Yeah, I sat behind George Foreman and Jim Brown. It was hard to see.
But Rosie Greer, I mean, they were this.
Rosie Greer was there.
This was like a heavyweight fight. I mean,
they were rooting for Billie Jean, most of them.
Yeah, the women were for Billie Jean, and the black athletes for the most part were for Billie Jean. Because again, women's live followed on the heels of civil rights, and so it was a big, big deal.
Mm-hmm.
So, in answer to your question, yeah, we were hopeful Bobby was going to win, but it was pretty clear early on it was not going to happen.
But you know what? It makes for a good documentary film, and one's in the works.
Well, yeah, here's what happened. Because if Margaret Court had beaten Bobby in the Mother's Day Massacre of May 13th, 1973, Mother's Day of 73.
No one remember. I don't remember that.
Played in Ramona up here at Ray Watts Community. But if Margaret had won, two things. Number one, the Battle of the Sexes never would have happened in the Astrodome. And number two, Margaret Court was not the one to carry the banner of women's lib. In fact, she didn't believe in it. She's a very religious Pentecostal minister to this day with a very successful TV show in Australia. Mm-hmm. And Billie Jean, of course, was the leading spokeswoman of all female athletes for women's lib. So it sort of played out perfectly in terms of how the fates dictated what finally happened.
Yeah. What Billie Jean King has done for sports and for women and for
tennis,
the freedom in our country. Mm-hmm. I mean, when they finally named the center in New York, the U.S. TA Tennis Center in her name, and finally they got it right, that she deserved the highest of honors.
Mm-hmm.
No question. But let's switch topics, because speaking of history in the country, a few years before the Battle of the Sexes, there was a very historic basketball game in January of 1968 down in the Houston Astrodome, the same place that the Battle of the Sexes got played, between the University of Houston and UCLA, pitting the great Lou Alcindor, who later became known as Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and Elvin Hayes, the great center for the Houston Cougars, coached by Guy Lewis. And this was a historical event because now those of us who watch basketball on TV with the Final Four and all these games on constantly all college basketball season long, I believe that was the first time there was a significant college basketball game that was not a Final Four game that was broadcast nationally. So it was a big risk to take, and you were the announcer, correct?
Exactly right. It was TVS, and Eddie Einhorn had this little syndicated network that put it all together. And not only they were the first in many ways. First of all, it was the largest crowd ever to pay to see a college or professional basketball game, 52,000 plus, played in the Astrodome. First time ever a college or professional game was televised nationwide in prime time that was not a championship game. And then for UCLA, number one, defending national champion, Houston, also undefeated, number two in the rankings, to meet. And again, it's much like if Billie Jean hadn't beaten Bobby Riggs, I think it would have diluted the impact of that event. At the time, we didn't know that. If UCLA had won, as they beat everyone in those days, it would have been another UCLA win in front of a big crowd. Instead, Houston won because Alcindor had been poked in the eye in a Cal game a week before and didn't see very well. I think he still scored 16-17. And Elvin Hayes had that multi-million dollar game where he scored 39 or 40 points, whatever it was. The right team won. I mean, and Coach Wooden always would get upset with me, and people would ask, well, what's the most important game you've ever called? And I said, well, the most important was the UCLA-Houston game. He said, don't you remember any of the winning games that we had?
Alcindor's record was 88-2 during those 3 years. That was one of his two losses.
That's right. Everybody loves the underdog.
I did UCLA solo. I flew solo. Didn't have any color man, and that's how I got, the only reason I got the game. It was the first time I was on national, that's another, it was my first time on national TV. You can imagine how excited
I
was.
That. Wow.
And my career's gone downhill ever since. That's the most important thing I've ever called.
Yeah, it's the last 44 years.
Hey, what is your favorite sport
baseball.
To call? Baseball.
Baseball's the best announcer game. It was the sport that I grew up with. I played, I coached, and I wasn't very good as a player, but I still dream about hitting the grand slam in the ninth inning to win for my side. It's Shakespearean. Baseball is. And a lot of people don't understand that and don't get the drift of why baseball is so intriguing. It's a two-man game. It's a battle, a constant battle between a pitcher and a batter. And once you understand that drama, then all the other eight players are just complementary. And they play important roles, mind you. But it's really that game between two trying to outwit, outperform, out-physical each other. And there's, what might make it boring for some, that there's not enough action, is exactly why it's exciting for an announcer, because we have a time to, unlike any other sport, to be able to weave stories in and talk about history. And baseball probably links to history better than any other sport. People remember baseball trivia. Football, basketball, no, not nearly as much. Tennis maybe, or individual sports, boxing or golf. But as a team sport, baseball is...
And in the national semifinals in April of 68... beat Houston, I mean, I think 101-69. I mean, it was just dominating performance.
You did all those games, too?
I didn't do that. I was there. I was still doing UCLA, but I was in the sports arena to see that game. And the first half of that game, it was the best half of basketball I've ever seen by any team, pro, college, or anywhere. Coach Wooden had a healthy Alcindor now, and that team was so ready to get. They put a box and one on Elvin Hayes. Elvin Hayes, I mean, if he tried to go to the restroom, he had two guys on him. And they had no chance. And everything UCLA shot that first half seemed to go in. It was.
And then the Bruins went on to beat North Carolina to win the national championship. Yeah. And the only other game Alcindor lost was against crosstown rival USC.
And Coach Wood never made more than $35,000 a year. Yeah. Never.
No, he corrected me. 32.5.
Oh, 32.5.
Okay. So sue me for 25.
Right, but getting back to baseball, Dick, I mean, I agree. I love the Shakespearean pace of the batter against the hitter. But the other beautiful thing in my mind about baseball is there's no clock, unlike basketball that goes 48 minutes or 40 minutes if it's college, or 60 minutes of football. Everybody gets 27 out.
Yeah, the pitcher can't take the in the ninth inning two on, put the ball down on the rubber and sit on it and let the clock run out. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's got to give the other team a chance to be able to win or lose. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about my father a lot. He's been gone a long time, and I guess I'm still trying to please my father. A lot of us men do that sort of thing. And I remember the first time he took me to a major league game in Briggs Stadium, then Tiger Stadium in Detroit, and I was thrilled to death. And we had moved from, after the war, from California back to Michigan, where in Midwest, his roots and my mother's roots.
You're about 10 years old or so?
Yeah, well, let's see. I was, you're right. I was about seventh grade. Mm-hmm. So... 12 years old. And we go to Detroit, and, Detroit is all concrete and not the nicest city even then in the world. And we get to Brooks Stadium, and he said, now I want you to really watch closely when we walk inside and get to our seats. So we walked, we had probably bleacher seats, that's all we could afford. And as we walked in, you see this magnificent, ballpark. I mean, is there any baseball park that isn't just beautiful to see the grass and the lines, and there's just a poetry about it all? And he said, I want you to always remember this, and I still always do, even when I go work every day at Petco Park. He said, we're in the middle of a city, but we're now in a ballpark. It's not just a baseball state, it's a ballpark. And it was such an image that he helped me to appreciate that I still do to this day.
I think everybody remembers their very first baseball game as a kid. I mean, going to a professional baseball stadium.
I remember mine.
I
saw history being made in 1964. Masanori Murakami pitched his first game as a relief pitcher for the San Francisco Giants, first Japanese-born major league player, first game I ever went to.
What ballpark was it?
That was Candlestick Park in San Francisco.
Okay.
I still have dirt in my ears.
Not the most beautiful ballpark for baseball, but nevertheless.
And, of course, I remember Comiskey Park, but, that was my first game. But we did see more Cubs game than White Sox. But you probably remember Bill Veeck. What a great promoter. With the midget and everything. Oh, my God. We went to a Twilight doubleheader. And he brought in Colonel Kez with the jet belt. Yes. And between games, this guy's flying around the ballpark, in his jet rocket belt. I mean, unbelievable. Where do you see these things today? I don't know.
Eddie Goodell put the midget up there with his hands.
Yeah. He got one at bat.
Dick, a lot of people ask you, where did you get the oh my? And I have
It's Midwestern expression. Okay. If you're in the Midwest and you just listen to the conversation in the marketplace or in the public, and it's an acclamation.
Part of the local.
The two people are talking, and one's saying, did you hear about the Joe boy, and the other says, oh my. or what a game. Did you see the college kids last night? Oh, my, wasn't that good? My mother said it a lot, mostly in despair and dismay at my behavior. Richard, oh, my.
She said, because she couldn't say, oh, something else.
She wouldn't say something else. The old wash your mouth in soap if I hear that again, if I said darn. And so when I started at Indiana, I left Central Michigan to go to Indiana. I received a graduate assistantship, and I went on to get my master's and doctorate there. But my very first day, I walked the campus, never been on the IU campus, and there's a sign saying, we're having auditions for the new Indiana University Sports Network. So I thought, that's good. So I signed up and eventually got that job. And the IU network started in 1957. We had 8 stations and it grew to 40. My color man was Phil Jones, who spent 30 years at CBS as the White House correspondent. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I'm doing Big Ten football. Not that Indiana really has ever been a Big Ten caliber football program, but the basketball was doggone good. Mm-hmm. And so I've got to get a call now. But all the religious calls, the exclamation points have been taken, Holy Toledo and Holy Cow and all of those. And so I thought, I'm going to try Oh My. And so
consciously go through a laundry list?
Oh, absolutely.
Really?
I said, I've got to have a signature call.
Awesome.
And so I tried Oh My, and then the guys in the graduate dorm after 3 or 4 games said, hey, Enberg, Oh My.
It worked.
So it's been a friend for all these years.
Hey, question, was Walt Bellamy playing basketball there?
Boy, you've got a great Richard.
To me, he's the best basketball player that nobody's ever heard of because he came along right after Russell and right after Wilt.
Bellamy was, people might remember an Ohio State team that won the national championship in 1960, beat, I think, Cal that year.
Right.
And they only had John Havlicek, Jerry Lucas, Mel Knoll,
Larry Siegfried.
Siegfried might have been gone.
Oh, and Bobby Knight.
Bob Knight came off the bench.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Walt Bellamy, they only lost one game all that year, and it was in Bloomington, and Bellamy and the Hoosiers beat him. Yeah, he was Olympian. Olympian.
Great center. But he came along at the wrong time in terms of being
very
famous.
Very good. A call for Walt Bellamy. I like it.
Oh, Richard's guy. He's a walking encyclopedia, for God's sake.
He's so scary.
But, we'll have to get to the Padres, obviously. How's the season going?
It hasn't gone well. I mean, April and May were disappointing, and some of the old dogs that we had and just didn't, age had gotten to them, and it was frustrating because, no one could have a pitching staff decimated like the Padres this year. It's just been as if
they've got more guys on the DL than they have in the bullpen bench.
Yeah.
It gets to be contagious after
Cincinnati,
a while.
We play Cincinnati today. Their same 5 starting pitchers have started every game all season long. They haven't had one change. Huh. The Padres have had 13 starting pitchers this year.
Wow.
13. And you'd expect to have 6 or 7.
How do you account for that? Has that ever happened?
Incredible.
Breaks of the game?
Yeah, the injuries of the game. You think of one in particular, Corey Lupke, a left-handed pitcher, and he was on his way to the All-Star game.
Yeah, darn good pitcher.
He's going to be brilliant. He's got Tommy John. We saw him at the end of the game today, and he won't be back to middle next year. So you got a combination of that, a team that didn't score a lot of runs, and now they've infused it with some young kids that are really, they have us all excited. So I look positively at it.
Great. Well, let's hold that thought. We got one more segment after we come back. Let's take a break. We'll be right back with more of It's Your Money, Not Theirs. Stay tuned.
Follow Glenn.
All right, we're We're back with our last segment, so we're going to try and talk fast. But next week, it's going to be Frank Parton, our USD law professor. He's a Wall Street expert, and you should really listen in on that. He was in Inside Job, the great film.
It's about his new book.
Yes, his new book is Wait, The Art and Science of Delay.
You're supposed to go wait, and then but anyway, we don't have time for that.
We don't have time to wait tonight. And then the following week is going to be the CEO of Stone Brewing Company, Greg Cook.
No, actually, the following week is, Dick will know this person, the former San Diego Padre and Native American painter, Gene Locklear.
Oh, Gene Locklear.
I believe Mr. Cook is the 29th.
You're right. I'm sorry. I skipped a week. So
Dick, getting back to baseball, there was an amazing play. I love baseball because of its geometry, the way the ball travels and the way that people move. There was an amazing play in center field by Cameron Maben, who's not hitting too well, but boy, can that gentleman field.
Yeah, we counted. It took him 17. The ball's hit to left center field. Looks like Ovado's going to get a home run. We counted, and Maben had to take 17 strides to get to the ball. And timed it perfectly, so as he was going to his backhand sign, leaped at the fence, and as he caught the ball, he splattered himself against the fence.
Robbed him of a home run.
And his wrist went over and hit the top of the wall, so it should have forced the ball out of his glove, and somehow he's able to squeeze it and fall back and take a home run away from Votto. I mean, you see one play like that, say, I want to go back and see this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, what I love about baseball, let's say you have a guy on first base and a guy hits one in the gap. When you look at the way the players move on the field, what the second baseman does, the shortstop does, where the pitcher moves. I mean, it's pure, if you think geometry is beautiful, I mean, baseball proves that.
And we were talking, it's interesting you brought that up today, because we were talking, Mark Sweeney was my color analyst, Mark Grant's on a holiday, and he had he was talking about hitting, and they had a freeze of Logan Forsythe's home run the other night, and how there's the whole geometry of the swing, so that you have the power of the legs, the arms coming through and meeting the ball, and how if that triangle is just right as you make contact with the ball, then it flies. And, there's geometry. We all had geometry in high school. Now you can go to the ballpark and refresh your mind.
You see it every inning at the ballpark.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So, Dick, I know you don't have the inside story, but do you think the O'Malley's are going to be the new owner?
That's the rumor. I really don't have the inside story. I wish I did. I've asked some people who have more information about it, and they say, what you read in the paper is probably right. I don't hear of any other ones that are interested. But the last minute, someone can come, you and Joe may decide to want to buy it, and then it all changes.
Yeah, but my concern is the July 31 deadline's coming up. We've got some great players like Houston Street and Carlos Quinton. They may be traded by July 31st. On the other hand, with new ownership, they might be signed to extensions,
exactly.
And these guys could actually play baseball.
Exactly. And it'd be nice if it was resolved before the end of the month. I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, I agree. It probably won't happen.
And the owner, John Morris, is on European holiday. It boggles my mind. Here's an $800 million deal, and the owner takes a holiday.
He can afford to, Dick.
I mean, this is a money show. I don't understand those terms.
The guy writes the checks, Dick. So.
There you go.
Yeah. So we're a minute till we're out, then, Dick? Okay. So then we better wrap it up right now, then. So, but I got to say, Dick Emberg, I was watching Wimbledon today, and
I missed you, Dick.
Thank you.
They may have the knowledge, they don't have the chops. I mean, this guy's got the great book.